Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week's episode is part two of a special historical investigation into rugby union's changing attitude to concussion. Last week we saw how the game had been aware of the dangers of concussion since at least 1975 and how this had been reiterated at its World Cup Medical Conference in 1991 and the following year at a major conference in New Zealand. It introduced a minimum 3-week stand-down period for players suffering from concussion and was involved in discussions about longer stand-downs after second and third concussions. However, in 1987, Rugby Union's first World Cup was staged and the forces propelling the sport to open professionalism started to accelerate. This led to a rise in the intensity of competition, which caused the 3-week stand-down rule to be questioned. In March 1988, the International Rugby Board noted that cases of concussion were given greater attention than formerly, but nevertheless, the 3-week mandatory exclusion from playing was not automatically being followed. The problem was highlighted during that November's England-Australia match at Twickenham. Late in the game, Will Carlin suffered 2 head injuries, but refused the England doctor's order to leave the pitch. The doctor had to ask the referee to tell Carlin to come off. There are also signs that some sports scientists were pushing back against what they saw as an overly cautious approach to head injuries. In 1991, a doctor involved in Australian rules football claimed that sports concussions weren't comparable to head injuries sustained at work or in accidents. For some sports scientists, head injuries became a management problem. Paul McCrory, the Australian sports scientist recently in the news after he admitted plagiarising the work of other researchers, claimed in 2002 the scientific evidence that sustaining a number of concussions over the course of a season or over a career causes chronic neurological dysfunction is non-existent. McCrory claimed that there was what he called neuromythology surrounding the analysis of concussion injuries. Despite this pushback, the RFU remained committed to the 3-week stand-down rule. So, in 1998, it published the RFU Handbook of Safe Rugby, which insisted that players who have suffered concussion or a loss of consciousness may not train or play for at least 3 weeks. They may only do so after they have undergone a neurological examination by a doctor. The following year, Dorothy Gronwall and Philip Wrightson, the Auckland-based neuroscientists who had identified the long-term risk of rugby head injuries in the 1970s, published a medical textbook on head injuries, which reiterated that it is well known that people who have been concussed a number of times, rugby footballers and boxers in particular, change character and lose some of their abilities. There is also good evidence that lasting but subtle changes can persist after single minor injuries. Nevertheless, this cautious stance came under increasing criticism from many sports scientists. In 2001, the first International Conference on Concussion in Sport was held in Vienna, endorsed by the International Olympic Committee, FIFA and other world sport governing bodies. The Vienna Conference established the Concussion in Sport Group. One of its leading members was Paul McCrory, who became its Correspondence Secretary in 2004. The International Rugby Board also started attending the group's conferences that same year. Amazingly, the group recommended that the minimum stand-down period for concussed athletes should be cut to only 6 days. For sports like rugby, which had a weekly cycle of matches, this meant that a concussed player could be considered fit to play for his club's next match. Moreover, the conference's summary and agreement statement, published at the end of the conference, said nothing about the potential long-term dangers of concussion. The group's third conference was held in 2008 and was attended by the IRB's first ever medical officer, former Ireland international Dr. Mick Molloy. The conference's consensus statement accepted that there was concern about the long-term risk of concussion, but suggested that mental health issues, such as depression in players who had been concussed, were caused by other factors. By 2008, the group was accepted by most of the world's major sports organisations as the leading medical authority on concussion, and they followed its recommendations. Yet the group continued to be agnostic, at best, about the potential long-term risk from concussion. Its 2012 conference statement, signed by World Rugby's then Chief Medical Officer Martin Raftery, declared that a cause and effect relationship has not as yet been demonstrated between chronic traumatic encephalopathy and concussions or exposure to contact sport. But outside of the group, neuroscientists were discovering more and more evidence which did demonstrate a relationship. In 2008, Anne Shuttleworth-Edwards and Sarah Radloff examined rugby union players from school to the national adult level who had suffered mild trauma brain injuries. Their findings raised concerns about the possible presence of clinically relevant neurocognitive vulnerability due to cumulative concussion, both reported and unreported, amongst a broad spectrum of players of rugby involved at a competitive level. International Rugby's first official medical conference in 2009 seems not to have discussed the long-term effects of concussion, but it did endorse the concussion in sport groups' positions. Finally, in May 2011, the International Rugby Board ended the 3-week stand-down rule for concussions for professional players. They could now resume playing just 6 days after sustaining a concussion if a medical practitioner agreed and they followed the graded return to play protocol, now known as the Head Injury Assessment, HIA. Interestingly, the general term medical practitioner replaced the more precise requirement of a proper neurological examination in the IRB's original resolution on concussion. Once again, rugby union and medical science were moving in opposite directions. In 2012, Vijay Khurana and AHK published an article called An Overview of Concussion in Sport, which said, if concussion is sustained multiple times during an athlete's life, it may well have substantial adverse health consequences in the long term. In 2015, Neil Pearce and other colleagues argued, sports involving repeated head trauma may have long-term risks of neurodegenerative disease. These neurodegenerative effects potentially include increased risks of impaired cognitive function and dementia, Parkinson's disease, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And in 2016, William Stewart and 5 other neurologists identified the first comprehensive report of pathologically confirmed CTE in a former rugby union player. So, at precisely the point that medical science was identifying the increased long-term effects of concussive brain injuries, the administrators of rugby union were following the policy of the Concussion in Sport Group, an organisation which did not accept that there was a link between concussion and long-term health issues. Why did this happen? To some extent, rugby union was alert to the danger of head injuries before most other sports. At the sport's first medical conference in Dublin in 1975 and at its 1991 World Cup medical conference in Edinburgh, leading rugby officials, who were also highly regarded neurosurgeons and senior doctors, pointed to the need to protect players from the long-term consequences of head injuries. But in the 21st century, these warnings were downplayed and the concussion protocols of the sport went into reverse, culminating in that 2011 decision to reduce the stand-down period for concussed players. Why did such a potentially dangerous backward step take place? A key part of the reason can be found when we look at the participants in the 1975 and 1991 medical conferences. Rugby union was still then a nominally amateur sport and retained its historic link to the medical profession. Many of its top officials were also distinguished surgeons and doctors. Two of the founding member clubs of the RFU were Guy's Hospital and King's College Hospital, and doctors had featured on its leading committee since the 1870s. These men were volunteers who gave their time to the sport because of their love of the game. But in the late 1980s, rugby union began to move closer to open professionalism. The first Rugby World Cup in 1987 started the countdown to the game abandoning its amateur principles and paying its players. The sport was also now becoming more intensely competitive. The motto that it's the taking part, not the winning that counts, which had always been slightly hypocritical anyway, was now completely abandoned. At the top levels of the game, winning would soon override everything else. And it wasn't just the playing of the game that was changed by professionalism. Professionalism itself was about much more than just paying players. The administrative organisation of the sport also became much bigger, much more bureaucratic, and much more powerful. The old voluntary structures of the sport began to dissolve, as rugby administration now became a well-paid career path, and hyper-competitive clubs sought to extract the maximum advantage over their opponents. And if that meant reducing the stand-down time for concussed players, so be it. The influence of the surgeons, doctors and other medical professionals who had volunteered their services to the game was diminished. Commercial and academic interests which sought to obtain contracts and grants from rugby union came to play an increasingly important role within the sport. And at the same time, ambitious sports scientists and other academics saw their university careers become dependent on the need to obtain grant funding from sports organisations. So a vicious circle had been created. Rugby needed to justify its new directions by pointing to evidence which supported its decisions, and sports academics needed rugby's funding. The only losers were the players. Today, there has never been more awareness of the dangers of concussion in rugby and the other football codes. Those players who suffered from bad decisions in the past deserve justice, and the players of today and the future deserve protection. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My Twitter handle is @ColinsTony, and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, together with the show notes for this episode. Until next time, thanks for listening.